right now on Current State.
How many first-time walkers coming up here?
Learn why a Michigan Labor Day tradition will see some big changes this year.
I started really intentionally trying to fill my life with experiences that would make me be a person in my students' lives that they would look and go, wow, I want to live like that.
From Grand Ledge to the White House, meet the Mid-Michigan woman now in the National Teachers Hall of Fame.
All of them combined barely make an hors d'oeuvre.
And there's concern that a creature the size of a pencil eraser may be trouble for the Great Lakes. Welcome back to the second half of Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Next weekend is Labor Day weekend, and a big Michigan tradition is the Mackinac Bridge Walk. It first took place in 1958, and every year it draws tens of thousands of participants from across Michigan and the United States. In a moment, you're going to get a first-hand account of what it's like to stroll across the bridge. But first, Capitol correspondent Rick Pluta shares some important security changes that will be in effect this year.
The bridge will be closed to vehicle traffic for about 5.5 hours during the annual Labor Day Bridge Walk. That's because of security concerns. The decision was made after terrorists drove cars and trucks into crowds in London, Stockholm, and Paris. Bill Gonatke chairs the Mackinac Bridge Authority. He says it's become harder to guarantee safety where large crowds gather.
So we're all working as hard and diligently as we can.
The plans for dealing with traffic backups include adding roadside porta-johns and water stations. Only emergency vehicles and buses ferrying bridge walkers will be allowed to operate on the bridge during the event. I'm Rick Pluta.
Now the tradition. A few years back, WKAR's Kevin Lavery made the journey along the five-mile span across the straits. Let's take a listen to how it went.
How many first-time walkers coming up here?
And what's your name, ma'am?
Lee Woods.
Where are you from?
St. Clair Shores.
First time on the bridge?
No. Probably, I don't know, is this my fifth time maybe? Something like that.
What are some of the things that you see on the bridge or the people maybe that you meet that seem to make it so characteristically Michigan?
Well, the views from the bridge, I don't think you see anywhere else. I mean, you're looking around and everywhere you look, there's something to see. And the people on the bridge are always really nice and talkative, so you meet new people. It's fun.
I'm Roger Shebor. I'm from Dearborn, Michigan.
Have you walked the bridge before?
Yes, this is my fourth time.
What's your best bridge memory?
I think the first one, because I am afraid of heights. And I had this person here hold my hand, walk over the bridge. We got up to the section where the grill is, and we walked over that as well. I said, the only way I'll walk it is if you hold my hand. And she did.
When you're weary, feeling small.
I'm Pamela Moore.
And you're from where?
Farmington, Michigan.
How many times have you done the bridge walk?
7 or 8.
Well, this is my first time, so what am I expecting as I get a little closer to the towers here?
A beautiful view. Hopefully we'll get a barge that will come under.
What's your name?
BJ Warga.
And where are you from, BJ?
Petoskey.
You're dressed as Superman?
Yep.
Why?
Just see all kinds of characters here, and I figured, why not, right? So last year I dressed up in a Star Trek outfit. This year I decided to switch it up.
So you wanted to see the characters, and they're seeing you?
Hi. Pretty much. It's all good.
Oh, you have a goal? Oh,
what's... Stand up there.
Your goal was to stand on one of the towers?
Yeah.
Submit a picture or something to... like something online or something like that, and you could win a lifetime, once in a lifetime experience and go to the top.
Well, Superman, you're supposed to scale tall buildings in a single bound, right? And we're walking right toward the South Tower. You're already dressed the part. Can you just take off right here and do it?
It's my day off.
It's Labor Day.
Yeah.
It's not in your union contract, right?
Right. Pretty much.
I can't think of a better way of ending that. From atop the Straits of Mackinac on the Mackinac Bridge, for Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Sail on, silver girl. Sail on.
morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule.
It's back to school time. Many students are already hitting the books or going back to class this week. 20 years of work inside Grand Ledge Public Schools has earned a former teacher there two visits to the White House. We talked with her months after being inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame in Kansas.
Here is Matinga Ragatz of Grand Ledge, Michigan, one of our newest honorees tonight.
It's an honor to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
What makes your learning style innovative?
I really focus on purpose. I believe that students ask us just the one question. They're always asking why. Like, why am I doing this? Why am I going to, when am I ever going to use this? And so for me, that's the crucial question to ask. It's very important for me to make sure that the kids have a response to not only their questions, but understand how to problem solve today.
We were talking about teaching global studies, mm-hmm. history, and world language. So what did that cover for you when you were teaching in Grand Ledge?
Well, you know, as a social studies teacher, it's a pretty wide field. So you do everything from history to marketing, economy. So it's a pretty wide field. So depending on your assignment. But global studies and world history was my specialty. I have an international background, and so I was able to really bring the global and just the world to my students. And part of the innovations that I did, again, I never taught a lesson the same year after year, simply because you have to engage a different group of students that come in with different variables. And of course, I traveled the world with the students. So every year we went to a different part of the world, whether it was East Asia, whether it was Africa, whether it's Europe, South America. And where there was news, we went.
Tell me about one of those trips.
Oh my goodness. I think one of my favorite moments was a trip to Japan that we did. We got a chance to go to the Japanese temple. And the kids learned things like meditation. They learned things about, changing their ideology, like the way that they deal with stress and anxiety. And I thought it was really interesting to go halfway across the world to learn something like that. We also went to China. We planted trees at the foot of the Great Wall with our pen pals. We've been to Europe to do a Cradle of the Civilization, of Western Civilization tour, where we go anywhere from Italy, Greece, we've done Spain. So we've done many, many trips, and each one has a specific memorable moment. And I think the best part is to watch the kids leave their hometowns, and some of them never even left the state, and go to a different country, watch them become independent, and watch them just blossom into these individuals. So, 10, 15, 30 days later, you're bringing them home, and they have grown eons.
Is there a certain moment that you remember seeing the light bulb go off and a child, telling you, wow, I didn't know that?
Oh, yeah. That's the addiction. That's, I think, as teachers, that's the part that this is why we keep going, when we see that light bulb. And so at every moment you see that. And I remember specifically one time, I believe we were in Florence, Italy. And we were doing the typical tourist museum tour. And I remember the docent in this museum telling them something about a specific exhibit that we were looking at. And the kids going, yeah, they were so excited about it. And I'm thinking, I told you that. I told you that in my book. I told you that in my classroom, but you see it here. But that kind of moment where you just kind of see them make the connection. You see them function as individuals. And I think for a teacher, that is so important, because it gives you the encouragement to continue to raise individuals, to continue to bring wonder into their lives.
You told NPR earlier this year, we've really helicoptered the kids. Mm-hmm. And what we're witnessing now is the kids saying, let me do it on my own. Let me try by myself. What did you mean by that?
I don't know. I think in the early 90s, this whole self-esteem philosophies came on, where everybody was getting, everybody gets a ribbon, everybody is a winner. In addition to that, we had, social media, where parents are now taking pictures of the kids and showing their beautiful and most perfect parenting styles. And I think that we have kind of developed a cult of, child worship, where we are forgetting that we are the adult and we are the guide, and we are turning our children into, you know, they're not able to function on their own. And so helicoptering by parents, teachers, students, school systems has become a way to not allow the kids to learn to their potential. So I believe that we are missing a chance to teach them to their potential when we insist on doing it for them.
So what interested you in this profession of teaching?
Well, actually, I came into teaching by accident. So I was originally going to law school. I was going to do international law, hopefully work at the UN sometime or some international post. But then I had to take a break from my studies. I think it was between college and law school, and had to. So I thought, well, you know, and while my husband was doing a PhD here at Michigan State University, and I thought, well, you know what, I'll just get a quick teaching degree. And at the time, it was within a year you could get a teaching degree, and I started teaching. And I just never looked back. I never looked back. I just thought, wow, this is really cool. I found something that I thought I could make a mark in, and that's why I did. I became a teacher.
May I ask, where did you grow up, and what did you, what profession did you originally think you were going to do when you grew up?
Right, sure. So my parents were diplomats, and so I thought, well, you know, that was my training. So I went to the schools, and I went to all the trainings to just kind of have that future. And my parents are originally from an island country of West Africa called Equatorial Guinea. And I was born in Spain, went to school in Germany, of course, also Spain, and then ended up here for my university studies. So I have a wide international background, especially once I became a teacher. I started also presenting abroad and internationally as well. And, I came to Michigan because my husband is from Michigan. So love brought me here.
We're speaking with Matina Ragatz, who was recently inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame. What was it like meeting President Trump and the First Lady?
You know, it's always an honor to go into the White House. It was my second time there. I was lucky enough to meet also President Obama as the Michigan Teacher of the Year. And it's always very enlightening to see the heart of the nation, the historic nature of this building, it's just always an honor to do that. So meeting President Trump was an interesting experience, but it wasn't about meeting the president. It was about being honored in the People's House.
How can parents become more actively involved in education?
That's a really good question. I think today parents have the ability to basically get on their smartphones and view everything that their children are doing, whether it's the lessons that the teacher has posted, whether it's a video that the teacher has made to instruct their student or their grade or their trajectory. So parents have a lot of information. And one of the things that the Age of Information has done is kind of created a little bit of made schools a little bit of an island. We've become really security conscious. So in order to get into a school, you have to have like the clearance level of going into the high school sometimes. And so I think both parents and schools, can do even a better job, even though they're doing a pretty good job in making sure we communicate. One of the things that I would love to see parents do is to open up their businesses for kids who have real-world experience, open up their expertise. Grandma, grandpa are, a source of history, living history. And I would love to see the schools more involved in the community and the kids more involved in the resolving the problems of the community as well as developing their community rather than being in an island all in the corner. Because in my opinion, we have in a high school, we have, 16-year-olds and up, they're healthy, they're strong, but they're sitting bored in the classroom rather than out in their communities putting their studies to work.
What advice do you have for young teachers?
For young teachers, I'd like to answer that question with a small story. I was doing my teaching job when I think 5-6 years into my teaching, and a student came to me once and said, "You know, you always talk about success and, you know, and going out there and getting what you want and doing all of these things. So why are you a teacher?" And that was such an eye opener, because I started asking myself this question, like, why would students want to learn from me? Like, what makes me a person that people want to that people want to be like, or role model, or hear from? And so after that, I started really intentionally trying to fill my life with experiences that would make me be a person in my students' lives that they would look and go, "Wow, I want to live like that. I want to be that person. Look at that person go," rather than just go hum-de-dum around my life, open a book, read it, and then just interpret it to the student. And so to a young teacher, I would say to them, why would students want to learn from you? And if you don't know the answer to that question, either rethink your profession or go about job crafting your job to make it into something that your students will really admire. Beneath the tweets and the spectacle, we do have in our nation a crisis in teaching, in the profession. There is a shortage of teachers today, and the system has stopped being able to attract new teachers. The School of Education, pretty much every university has seen their numbers drop. Parents don't want their kids to be teachers. Teachers don't want their kids to be teachers. Really good teachers are reconsidering the profession and going to other professions. And the teachers that are staying are really disappointed with the system. So, one of the things that I would like to encourage my peers this year is to really, you know, search for the right question. Sometimes we go about asking about, what can I change? We need to innovate. We need to do this. But I really want to ask them, you know, what can you do that matters? Like, what is it that you can do that matters in your profession so that we can regain the ability to innovate our own profession rather than rely on people from the outside to tell us what to do? And I believe that, right now it's the time. It's the time right now because of all the access to technology, all the access to experts. I would like to encourage my teachers or my colleagues to start viewing themselves as experts and stop portraying the profession as mundane, when really we are just as important as your doctor, because we do affect your entire life and not just one day.
Thank you for joining us, Matinga Ragatz, recently inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame.
Thank you so much for having me.
This girl is on fire. This girl is on fire. She's walking on fire. This girl is on fire.
People around America are still talking about the science lesson we witnessed last Monday. A solar eclipse literally turned day into night and back into day in many parts of the country. Here in Michigan, we saw a partial eclipse. Like many of you, I went to the MSU Observatory to take it all in. Staring into the heavens with special solar sunglasses, Holt High School student Eli Sharkey and his sister Faith described the moon covering the sun.
Kind of like an orange Pac-Man.
It kind of looked like a wheel of cheese that had a little chunk put out of it.
Their grandmother Dina loves sharing this moment with family.
Great way to learn about the world. And it's not something that you normally see.
Lynette Griffin brought her son, daughter-in-law, and 3 grandkids.
Kind of looks like the moon, but it's brighter and like more yellow. Pretty awesome. We were just talking about how it makes us feel kind of like insignificant when you realize like things can change.
Watching the eclipse with strangers made the moment special for Rebecca Amon of East Lansing.
Almost cried. It gave me faith in humanity to see so many people of every color, every background, every clothing style even.
Once upon a time there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
Summer is winding down, but the danger of drowning at one of our Great Lakes remains a constant. WKAR's Corel Vega talked with a man trying to raise awareness and save lives.
Dave Benjamin is the Executive Director of Public Relations and Project Management at the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project. The project is a nonprofit that aims to reduce the number of Great Lakes drownings. There have been 63 Great Lakes drownings in 2017 alone. Benjamin says people need to start treating drowning as seriously as other public dangers like disease and bullying.
Why does it continue to be a neglected public health issue? And I would say, you know, lawmakers, politicians, the mass population just don't know. It's a leading cause of accidental death, and they don't know how to survive a drowning emergency.
Benjamin says one easy way to avoid accidental drowning is simply to bring a life jacket to the beach.
You do not always have to wear it, but have it with you because, you know, it may be a rough day. Put the kids in a life jacket. Put yourself in a life jacket.
The Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project estimates there have been 600 Great Lakes drownings since 2010. For a full weather forecast and to see all hazardous condition warnings, visit and like our Facebook page, WKAR News. For WKAR, I'm Corel Vega.
It's no bigger than a pencil eraser, but a tiny shrimp living in the Great Lakes is causing big concerns. Our reporting partners at Great Lakes Today are always keeping an eye on possible invasive species. Today, Ben Thorpe tells us why this tiny creature is such a mystery.
The bloody red shrimp is roughly the size of a pencil eraser. They came to the Great Lakes around 2006 in the ballast water of cargo ships coming from the Black Sea. Since then, they've worked their way into all of the Great Lakes other than Superior.
What we know about them is they eat a variety of food items, mostly animal plankton, and algae.
This is Scott McNaught. He's a biology professor at Central Michigan University. I casually refer to the bloody red shrimp as invasive, and he grimaces.
Oh, I certainly didn't mean to make a face, but invasive is kind of a tricky word. We like to say they're an organism is invasive if it's causing some negative impact on the environment, or economic impact, or even an aesthetic impact.
So for the moment, McNaught says they are simply non-native. Emily Wimmer is a graduate assistant of Scott's. She's doing research to answer whether the bloody red shrimp could have a positive impact on the Great Lakes ecosystem.
What can we do with them? How can they benefit? Do they serve a purpose to something? And here we have a native species, these lake trout fry. They're struggling to survive. Can these fry utilize it as a food source? Can we have a native predator of the Great Lakes come back?
Wimmer says Michigan is struggling to get lake trout to reproduce naturally in the environment, and some people think a lack of food is the problem. Maybe, she says, the bloody red shrimp could become a food source.
Like I said, it's pretty cold. It's set at 50 right now.
McNaught and Wimmer take me down to their lab, where tiny blue-gray fish dart around a giant green tub. The lab is chilly, to mimic the cold temperatures of the Great Lakes. On a table across from the giant tub are tiny containers for the bloody red shrimp, marked small, medium, and large. The shrimp don't look like much, translucent with spots of red, so tiny they are barely visible.
All of them combined barely make an hors d'oeuvre.
They're not worth eating.
They are not worth eating at all. You'd be very hungry.
Not worth eating for humans, maybe, but Wimmer says the results have been conclusive for young lake trout, known as fry.
Well, first of all, the lake trout fry are able to eat these hemimysis. That was the big question that we were looking for.
So there's scientific evidence that bloody red shrimp doesn't need to be called invasive, right? Not so fast, says McNaught. One of his experiments involves invasive quagga mussels. He thinks the mussels and bloody red shrimp together could decimate plankton populations, which are essential to the local ecosystem. In the end, a Michigan committee will decide whether to label the bloody red shrimp as invasive. Even though the shrimp has already made its home in Michigan, it could still be classified as invasive. Joanne Foreman, handles communications on invasives for several state agencies.
Well, we never say it's already here, it's too late. I mean, we do look at different stages of invasion. And then at each stage, we have to determine what is feasible and reasonable, what sort of actions may be able to contain and eradicate that species, or whether it's not possible to do so. So how do we manage the effects and try to reduce the spread of that population?
McNaught and Wimmer say it's too early to label the bloody red shrimp.
So what I'm trying to say is science is not black and white.
It's gray,
it's fuzzy, the screen keeps going on the fritz.
Until more definitive research comes along, the bloody red shrimp will continue to swim in that gray area. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Ben Thorpe.
That's it for this weekend's Current State. WKER radio station manager is Peter Worf. Our general manager is Susie Elkins. I'm WKER digital news director Reginald Hardwick. And if you want to see the videos that go with the music you heard on this program today, just head over to WKER.org and open our Current State story. Thanks for listening. We are taking Labor Day weekend off, but we'll be back on September 9th.
I want to follow where she goes. I think about her and she knows it. I want to let it take control. Cause every time that she gets closer, she pulls me in enough to keep me guessing. Start confessing, yeah. Oh, I've been shaking. I love it when you go crazy. You take all my inhibitions. Baby, there's nothing holding me back. You take me places that tear up my reputation. Manipulate my decisions. Baby, there's nothing holding me back. Says that she's never afraid.